If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. You can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. Welcome to the Voice Over Work podcast, an eclectic collection of motivational thoughts, news stories, and research from some of the newest audiobooks on the market. This podcast is brought to you by Newton Media Group, a family of creative services. This is Russell Newton. I'll be your host for the podcast, and thank you for listening. Hope things are going well for you today. On the podcast today, we take a little deeper look into a book introduced in a previous podcast with a chapter-by-chapter look at Thomas Paine Collection, Common Sense, The Age of Reason, and The Rights of Man by Thomas Paine, narrated by Russell Newton. Part 1. Chapter 1. The Author's Profession of Faith. It's been my intention for several years past to publish my thoughts upon religion. I am well aware of the difficulties that attend the subject, and from that consideration, had reserved it to a more advanced period of life. I intended it to be the last offering I should make to my fellow citizens of all nations, and that at a time when the purity of the motive that induced me to it could not admit of a question, even by those who might disapprove the work. The circumstance that has now taken place in France of the total abolition of the whole national order of priesthood and of everything appertaining to compulsive systems of religion and compulsive articles of faith has not only precipitated my intention, but rendered a work of this kind exceedingly necessary, lest, in the general wreck of superstition, of false systems of government, and false theology, we lose sight of morality, of humanity, and of the theology that is true. As several of my colleagues and others of my fellow citizens of France have given me the example of making their voluntary and individual profession of faith, I will also make mine, and I do this with all that sincerity and frankness with which the mind of man communicates with itself. I believe in one God and no more, and I hope for happiness beyond this life. I believe the equality of man, and I believe that religious duties consist in doing justice, loving mercy, and endeavoring to make our fellow creatures happy. But lest it should be supposed that I believe many other things in addition to these, I shall, in the progress of this work, declare the things I do not believe, and my reasons. Chapter 2. Of Missions and Revelations. Every national church or religion has established itself by pretending some special mission from God, communicated to certain individuals. The Jews have their Moses, the Christians their Jesus Christ, their apostles and saints, and the Turks their Mahomet, as if the way to God was not open to every man alike. Each of those churches shows certain books, which they call Revelation, or the Word of God. The Jews say that their Word of God was given by God to Moses face to face. The Christians say that their Word of God came by divine inspiration, and the Turks say that their Word of God, the Quran, was brought by an angel from heaven. Each of those churches accuses the other of unbelief, and for my own part, I disbelieve them all. As it's necessary to affix right ideas to words, I will, before I proceed further into the subject, offer some observations on the word revelation. Revelation, when applied to religion, means something communicated immediately from God to man. No one will deny or dispute the power of the Almighty to make such a communication, if he pleases, but admitting, for the sake of a case, that something has been revealed to a certain person and not revealed to any other person, it is revelation to that person only. When he tells it to a second person, a second to a third to a fourth, and so on, it ceases to be a revelation to all those persons. It is a revelation to the first person only and hearsay to every other, and consequently, they are not obliged to believe it. It is a contradiction in terms and ideas to call anything a revelation that comes to us at second hand, either verbally or in writing. Chapter 3, Concerning the Character of Jesus Christ and His History. Nothing that is here said can apply, even with the most distant disrespect, to the real character of Jesus Christ. He was a virtuous and an amiable man. The morality that he preached and practiced was of the most benevolent kind. And though similar systems of morality had been preached by Confucius and by some of the Greek philosophers many years before, by the Quakers since, and by many good men in all ages, it has not been exceeded by any. Jesus Christ wrote no account of himself, of his birth, parentage, or anything else. Not a line of what is called the New Testament is of his writing. The history of him is altogether the work of other people. And as to the account given of his resurrection and ascension, it was the necessary counterpart to the story of his birth. His historians, having brought him into the world in a supernatural manner, were obliged to take him out again in the same manner, or the first part of the story must have fallen to the ground. The wretched contrivance with which this latter part is told exceeds everything that went before it. The first part, that of the miraculous conception, was not a thing that admitted of publicity, and therefore the tellers of this part of the story had this advantage that, though they might not be credited, they could not be detected. They could not be expected to prove it, because it was not one of those things that admitted of proof, and it was impossible that the person of whom it was told could prove it himself. But the resurrection of a dead person from the grave and his ascension through the air is a thing very different, as to the evidence it admits of, to the invisible conception of a child in the womb. The resurrection and ascension, supposing them to have taken place, admitted of public and ocular. Chapter 4, Of the Bases of Christianity. It is upon this plain narrative of facts, together with another case I'm going to mention, that the Christian mythologists, calling themselves the Christian Church, have erected their fable, which, for absurdity and extravagance, is not exceeded by anything that's to be found in the mythology of the ancients. The ancient mythologists tell us that the race of giants made war against Jupiter, and that one of them threw 100 rocks against him at one throw, that Jupiter defeated him with thunder and confined him afterwards under Mount Etna, and that every time the giant turns himself, Mount Etna belches fire. It is here easy to see that the circumstance of the mountain, that of its being a volcano, suggested the idea of the fable, and that the fable is made to fit and wind itself up with that circumstance. The Christian mythologists tell that there Satan made war against the Almighty, who defeated him and confined him afterwards not under a mountain, but in a pit. It is here easy to see that the first fable suggested the idea of the second, for the fable of Jupiter and the giants was told many hundred years before that of Satan. Thus far, the ancient and the Christian mythologists differ very little from each other, but the latter have contrived to carry the matter much further. They have contrived to connect the fabulous part of the story of Jesus Christ with the fable originating from Mount Etna, and in order to make all the parts of the story tie together, they've taken to their aid the traditions of the Jews. For the Christian mythology is made up partly from the ancient mythology and partly from the Jewish traditions. The Christian mythologists, after having confined Satan in a pit, were obliged to let him out again. Chapter 5, Examination in Detail of the Preceding Bases. Putting aside everything that might excite laughter by its absurdity or detestation by its profaneness, and confining ourselves merely to an examination of the parts, it is impossible to conceive a story more derogatory to the Almighty, more inconsistent with His wisdom, more contradictory to His power than this story is. In order to make for it a foundation to rise upon, the inventors were under the necessity of giving to the being whom they call Satan a power equally as great, if not greater, than they attribute to the Almighty. They've not only given him the power of liberating himself from the pit after what they call his fall, but they have made that power increase afterwards to infinity. Before this fall, they represent him only as an angel of limited existence, as they represent the rest. After his fall, he becomes, by their account, omnipresent. He exists everywhere, and at the same time, he occupies the whole immensity of space. Not content with this deification of Satan, they represent him as defeating by stratagem, in the shape of an animal of the creation, all the power and wisdom of the Almighty. They represent him as having compelled the Almighty to the direct necessity either of surrendering the whole of creation to the government and sovereignty of this Satan, or of capitulating for its redemption by coming down upon earth and exhibiting himself upon a cross in the shape of a man. Had the inventors of this story told it the contrary way, that is, had they represented the Almighty as compelling Satan to exhibit himself on a cross in the shape of a snake as a punishment for his new transgression, the story would have been less obscure. Chapter 6 of the True Theology. But if objects for gratitude and admiration are our desire, do they not present themselves every hour to our eyes? Do we not see a fair creation prepared to receive us the instant we're born? A world furnished to our own hands that costs us nothing? Is it that we light up the sun, that pour down the rain, and fill the earth with abundance? Whether we sleep or wake, the vast machinery of the universe still goes on. Are these things, and the blessings they indicate in future, nothing to us? Can our gross feelings be excited by no other subjects than tragedy and suicide? Or has the gloomy pride of man become so intolerable that nothing can flatter it but a sacrifice of the Creator? I know that this bold investigation will alarm many, but it would be paying too great a compliment to their credulity to forbear it on that account. The times and the subject demand it to be done. The suspicion that the theory of what is called the Christian Church is fabulous is becoming very extensive in all countries. And it will be a consolation to men staggering under that suspicion and doubting what to believe and what to disbelieve to see the subject freely investigated. I therefore pass on to an examination of the books called the Old and the New Testament. Chapter 7, Examination of the Old Testament. These books, beginning with Genesis and ending with Revelations, which, by the by, is a book of riddles that requires a revelation to explain it, are, we are told, the Word of God. It is, therefore, proper for us to know who told us so, that we may know what credit to give to the report. The answer to this question is that nobody can tell, except that we tell one another so. The case, however, historically, appears to be as follows. When the church mythologists established their system, they collected all the writings they could find and managed them as they pleased. It's a matter altogether of uncertainty to us whether such of the writings as now appear under the name of the Old and the New Testament are in the same state in which those collectors say they found them, or whether they added, altered, abridged, or dressed them up. Be this as it may, they decided, by vote, which of the books out of the collection they had made should be the Word of God, and which should not. They rejected several. They voted others to be doubtful, such as the books called the Apocrypha, and those books which had a majority of votes were voted to be the Word of God. Had they voted otherwise, all the people, since calling themselves Christians, had believed otherwise, for the belief of the one comes from the vote of the other. Who the people were that did all this, we know nothing of. They call themselves by the general name of the Church, and this is all we know of the matter. As we have no external evidence or authority for believing these books to be the Word of God than what I've mentioned, which is no evidence or authority at all, I come in the next place to examine the internal evidence contained in the books themselves. Chapter 8 of the New Testament. Thus much for the Bible. I now go on to the book called the New Testament. The New Testament, that is, the new will, as if there could be two wills of the Creator. Had it been the object or the intention of Jesus Christ to establish a new religion, he would undoubtedly have written the system himself, or procured it to be written in his lifetime. But there is no publication extant authenticated with his name. All the books called the New Testament were written after his death. He was a Jew by birth and by profession, and he was the Son of God in like manner that every other person is, for the Creator is the Father of all. The first four books, called Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, do not give a history of the life of Jesus Christ, but only detached anecdotes of him. It appears from these books that the whole time of his being a preacher was not more than 18 months, and it was only during this short time that those men became acquainted with him. They make mention of him at the age of 12 years, sitting, they say, among the Jewish doctors, asking and answering them questions. As this was several years before their acquaintance with him began, it is most probable that they had this anecdote from his parents. From this time, there is no account of him for about 16 years. Where he lived or how he employed himself during this interval is not known. Most probably, he was working at his father's trade, which was that of a carpenter. It does not appear that he had any school education, and the probability is that he could not write, for his parents were extremely poor, as appears from their not being able to pay for a bed when he was born. It is somewhat curious that the three persons whose names are the most universally recorded were of very obscure parentage. Chapter 9. In what the true revelation consists. But some perhaps will say, are we to have no word of God, no revelation? I answer, yes, there is a word of God. There is a revelation. The Word of God is the creation we behold, and it is in this Word, which no human intervention can counterfeit or alter, that God speaketh universally to man. Human language is local and changeable, and is therefore incapable of being used as the means of unchangeable and universal information. The idea that God sent Jesus Christ to publish, as they say, the glad tidings to all nations from one end of the earth to the other is consistent only with the ignorance of those who know nothing of the extent of the world and who believed, as those world saviors believed, and continued to believe for several centuries, and that in contradiction to the discoveries of philosophers and the experience of navigators that the earth was flat like a trencher, and that a man might walk to the end of it. But how is Jesus Christ to make anything known to all nations? He could speak but one language, which was Hebrew, and there are in the world several hundred languages. Scarcely any two nations speak the same language or understand each other, and as to translations, every man who knows anything of languages knows that it is impossible to translate from one language into another, not only without losing a great part of the original, but frequently of mistaking the sense. And besides all this, the art of printing was wholly unknown at the time Christ lived. It is always necessary that the means that are to accomplish any end be equal to the accomplishment of that end, or the end cannot be accomplished. It is in this. Chapter 10. Concerning God and the lights cast on his existence and attributes by the Bible. The only idea man can affix to the name of God is that of a first cause, the cause of all things. And incomprehensibly difficult as it is for a man to conceive what a first cause is, he arrives at the belief of it from the tenfold greater difficulty of disbelieving it. It is difficult beyond description to conceive that space can have no end, but it is more difficult to conceive an end. It's difficult beyond the power of man to conceive an eternal duration of what we call time, but it is more impossible to conceive a time when there shall be no time. In like manner of reasoning, everything we behold carries in itself the internal evidence that it did not make itself. Every man is an evidence to himself that he did not make himself. Neither could his father make himself, nor his grandfather, nor any of his race. neither could any tree, plant, or animal make itself. And it is the conviction arising from this evidence that carries us on, as it were, by necessity, to the belief of a first cause eternally existing, of a nature totally different to any material existence we know of, and by the power of which all things exist. And this first cause, man calls God. It is only by the exercise of reason that man can discover God. Take away that reason, and he would be incapable of understanding anything. And in this case, it would be just as consistent to read even the book called the Bible to a horse as to a man. How then is it that those people pretend to reject reason? Almost the only parts in the book called the Bible that convey to us any idea of God are some chapters in Job and the ninth. Chapter 11 of the Theology of the Christians and the True Theology. As to the Christian system of faith, it appears to me as a species of atheism, a sort of religious denial of God. It professes to believe in a man rather than in God. It is a compound made up chiefly of manism with but little deism, and is as near to atheism as twilight is to darkness. It introduces between man and his maker an opaque body, which it calls a redeemer, as the moon introduces her opaque self between the earth and the sun, and it produces by this means a religious or an irreligious eclipse of light. It has put the whole orbit of reason into shade. The effect of this obscurity has been that of turning everything upside down and representing it in reverse. And among the revolutions it has thus magically produced, it has made a revolution in theology. That which is now called natural philosophy, embracing the whole circle of science, of which astronomy occupies the chief place, is the study of the works of God, and of the power and wisdom of God in his works, and is the true theology. As to the theology that is now studied in its place, it is the study of human opinions and of human fancies concerning God. It is not the study of God himself in the works that he has made, but in the works or writings that man has made. And it is not among the least of the mischiefs that the Christian system has done to the world that it has abandoned the original and beautiful system of theology, like a beautiful innocent, to distress and reproach, to make room for the hag of superstition. The book of Job and the 19th Psalm, which even the church admits to being more ancient. Chapter 12, The Effects of Christianism on Education, Proposed Reforms. As the Christian system of faith has made a revolution in theology, so also has it made a revolution in the state of learning. That which is now called learning was not learning originally. Learning does not consist, as the schools now make it consist, in the knowledge of languages, but in the knowledge of things to which language gives names. The Greeks were a learned people, but learning with them did not consist in speaking Greek, any more than in a Roman's speaking Latin, or a Frenchman's speaking French, or an Englishman's speaking English. From what we know of the Greeks, it does not appear that they knew or studied any language but their own, and this was one cause of their becoming so learned. It afforded them more time to apply themselves to better studies. The schools of the Greeks were schools of science and philosophy, and not of languages, and it is in the knowledge of the things that science and philosophy teach that learning consists. Almost all the scientific learning that now exists came to us from the Greeks, or the people who spoke the Greek language. It therefore became necessary to the people of other nations, who spoke a different language, that some among them should learn the Greek language, in order that the learning the Greeks had might be made known in those nations, by translating the Greek books of science and philosophy into the mother tongue of each nation. The study, therefore, of the Greek language, and in the same manner for the Latin, was no other than the drudgery business of a linguist, and the language thus obtained was no other than the means, or, as it were, the tools, employed to obtain the learning the Greeks had. It made no part of the learning itself, and was so distinct from it. Chapter 13, comparison of Christianism with the religious ideas inspired by nature. Having thus shown from the internal evidence of things the cause that produced a change in the state of learning and the motive for substituting the study of the dead languages in the place of the sciences, I proceed, in addition to the several observations already made in the former part of this work, to compare, or rather to confront, the evidence that the structure of the universe affords with the Christian system of religion. But as I cannot begin this part better than by referring to the ideas that occurred to me at an early part of life, and which I doubt not have occurred in some degree to almost every other person at one time or other, I shall state what those ideas were, and add thereto such other matter as shall arise out of the subject, giving to the whole, by way of preface, a short introduction. My father, being of the Quaker profession, it was my good fortune to have an exceedingly good moral education and a tolerable stock of useful learning. Though I went to the grammar school, I did not learn Latin, not only because I had no inclination to learn languages, but because of the objection the Quakers have against the books in which the language is taught. But this did not prevent me from being acquainted with the subjects of all the Latin books used in the school. The natural bent of my mind was to science. I had some turn, and I believe some talent for poetry, but this I rather repressed than encouraged, as leading too much into the field of imagination. As soon as I was able, I purchased a pair of globes and attended the philosophical lectures of Martin and Ferguson, and became afterwards acquainted with Dr. Bevis of the society called the Royal Society, then living in the Temple, and an excellent astronomer. Chapter 14, System of the Universe. That part of the universe that is called the solar system, meaning the system of worlds to which our Earth belongs, and of which Sol, or in English language the Sun, is the center, consists, beside the Sun, of six distinct orbs, or planets, or worlds, besides the secondary bodies, called the satellites or moons, of which our Earth has one that attends her in her annual revolution around the Sun, in like manner as the other satellites or moons attend the planets or worlds to which they severally belong, as may be seen by the assistance of the telescope. The Sun is the center round which those six worlds or planets revolve at different distances therefrom, and in circles concentric to each other. Each world keeps constantly in nearly the same track round the Sun, and continues at the same time turning round itself in nearly an upright position, as a top turns round itself when it's spinning on the ground and leans a little sideways. It is this leaning of the Earth, 23.5 degrees, that occasions summer and winter, and the different lengths of days and nights. If the Earth turned round itself in a position perpendicular to the plane or level of the circle it moves in round the Sun, as a top turns round when it stands erect on the ground, the days and nights would be always of the same length, 12 hours day and 12 hours night, and the seasons would be uniformly the same throughout the year. Every time that a planet, our Earth for example, turns round itself, it makes what we call day and night. And every time it goes entirely round the Sun, it makes what we call a year. Consequently, our world turns 365 times round itself in going once round. Chapter 15, Advantages of the Existence of Many Worlds in Each Solar System. It is an idea I have never lost sight of, that all our knowledge of science is derived from the revolutions exhibited to our eye, and from thence to our understanding, which those several planets or worlds of which our system is composed make in their circuit round the Sun. Had then the quantity of matter which these six worlds contain been blended into one solitary globe, the consequences to us would have been that either no revolutionary motion would have existed, or not a sufficiency of it to give us the ideas and the knowledge of science we now have. And it is from the sciences that all the mechanical arts that contribute so much to our earthly felicity and comfort are derived. As, therefore, the Creator made nothing in vain, so also must it be believed that he organized the structure of the universe in the most advantageous manner for the benefit of man. And as we see and from experience feel, the benefits we derive from the structure of the universe, formed as it is, which benefits we should not have had the opportunity of enjoying if the structure, so far as it relates to our system, had been a solitary globe, we can discover at least one reason why a plurality of worlds has been made, and that reason calls forth the devotional gratitude of man, as well as his admiration. But it's not to us, the inhabitants of this globe only, that the benefits arising from a plurality of worlds are limited. The inhabitants of each of the worlds of which our system is composed enjoy the same opportunities of knowledge as we do. They behold the revolutionary motions of our Earth as we behold theirs. All the planets revolve inside of it. Chapter 16, Application of the Proceeding to the System of the Christians. But, in the midst of those reflections, what are we to think of the Christian system of faith that forms itself upon the idea of only one world, and that of no greater extent, as is shown before, than 25,000 miles? An extent which a man, walking at the rate of 3 miles an hour for 12 hours in the day, could he keep on in a circular direction, would walk entirely round in less than 2 years. Alas, what is this to the mighty ocean of space and the almighty power of the Creator? From whence then could arise the solitary and strange conceit that the Almighty, who had millions of worlds equally dependent on His protection, should quit the care of all the rest and come to die in our world because, they say, one man and one woman had eaten an apple? And, on the other hand, are we to suppose that every world in the boundless creation had an Eve, an apple, a serpent, and a redeemer? In this case, the person who is irreverently called the Son of God, and sometimes God Himself, would have nothing else to do than to travel from world to world in an endless succession of death, with scarcely a momentary interval of life. It has been by rejecting the evidence that the word or works of God in the creation affords to our senses and the action of our reason upon that evidence that so many wild and whimsical systems of faith and of religion have been fabricated and set up. There may be many systems of religion that, so far from being morally bad, are in many respects morally good, but there can be but one that is true. And that one necessarily must, as it ever will, be in all things consistent. Chapter 17. Of the means employed in all time, and almost universally, to deceive the peoples. Having thus shown the irreconcilable inconsistencies between the real Word of God existing in the universe and that which is called the Word of God, as shown to us in a printed book that any man might make, I proceed to speak of the three principal means that have been employed in all ages, and perhaps in all countries, to impose upon mankind. Those three means are mystery, miracle, and prophecy. The first two are incompatible with true religion, and the third ought always to be suspected. With respect to mystery, everything we behold is, in one sense, a mystery to us. Our own existence is a mystery. The whole vegetable world is a mystery. We cannot account how it is that an acorn, when put into the ground, is made to develop itself and become an oak. We know not how it is that the seed we sow unfolds and multiplies itself, and returns to us such an abundant interest for so small a capital. The fact, however, as distinct from the operating cause, is not a mystery, because we see it, and we know also the means we are to use, which is no other than putting the seed in the ground. We know, therefore, as much as is necessary for us to know, and that part of the operation that we do not know, and which if we did we could not perform, the Creator takes upon Himself and performs it for us. We are therefore better off than if we have been let into the secret and left to do it for ourselves. But though every created thing is, in this case, a mystery, the word mystery cannot be applied to moral truth, any more than obscurity can be applied to light. The God in whom we believe is a God of moral truth. The Age of Reason. More information regarding today's book and the author can be found at audible.com or amazon.com. With an eclectic collection of water cooler knowledge, inspirational stories, and motivational thoughts from some of the newest audiobooks on the market, this has been the Voice Over Work podcast, brought to you by Newton Media Group, a family of creative services.